This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
People in several countries join naval parades in solidarity with Palestinians on the eve of International Quds Day. Iran's president calls on the Islamic countries to form a united front to stop the Zionist regime's crimes against Palestinians. Also coming up, North Korea says it's fired a new solid-fuel intercontinental ballistic missile in its latest test, which greatly improves the country's strategic deterrence.
Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us.
Our top story this hour, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has held naval drills in the waters off the Persian Gulf and the Caspian Sea in a show of support for the Palestinian people. Over 2,700 boats operated by volunteer besieged forces and ordinary people participated in the drills. Similar maneuvers were held in Yemen's port of Hodeidah, as well as several other Islamic countries. This as the Israeli regime has ramped up atrocities against the Palestinians during the holy month of Ramadan and has regularly conducted deadly raids into Palestinian towns. The regime has killed around 100 Palestinians so far this year. Iran's president has called on the Islamic countries to form a united front in order to stop the Zionist regime's criminal acts against Palestinians. Ibrahim Raisi made the remark in a phone call with Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif on the eve of International Quds Day. He expressed over the latest developments in the occupied territories, especially the Zionist regime's desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Sharif, for his part, strongly condemned Israel's crimes, saying his country will remain a permanent supporter. He also expressed hope that the Organization of Islamic Cooperation would take steps to establish a united front to prevent continuation of the regime's crimes. The last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan is designated as International Quds Day. The occasion is marked by mass rallies in all major cities worldwide. On the eve of this year's Quds Day, a conference has been held in the holy city of Mazar-e-Sharif, Iran, describing Al-Quds as the common heritage of all religions. Gisu Misha Ahmadi has more.
A symbol of unity in the Muslim world, Al-Quds is a common heritage for followers of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. And every year, on the occasion of International Quds Day, this becomes the topic of discussion in conferences that are usually held a day before. This year is no different. Political figures and activists gathered in Imam Rizā's holy shrine to emphasize the same persistent and unchangeable policy of supporting the liberation of Al-Quds and the legitimate resistance of the Palestinian nation.
The freedom of Al-Quds is not just a Palestinian issue. It is an issue for all Muslims and freedom seekers all over the world. It is what we all pray for.
The legacy of the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. The last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan is designated as International Quds Day in solidarity with Palestinians. On this day, mass rallies are held worldwide in all major cities.
International Quds is very important for us, for all of the Muslims in the world, because Quds have to be free.
The main purpose of this conference is to shed light on the plight of Palestinians as an issue of high priority in the Muslim world and also discuss how Quds Day rallies have raised public opinion on the sufferings of the Palestinians.
The Palestinian resistance movement is bearing fruit thanks to the annual International Goods Day rallies. We can already see how it has raised public awareness, which in turn has had a direct effect, particularly on the economic activities of the Zionist regime. The political changes that you see in the region are a result of that.
According to the participants of this conference, International Quds Day this year is even more significant because of the recent regional and international developments, and it also sends a very strong message to the world. Gisumi Shah Ahmadi, Mashhad.
North Korea says it has fired a new solid-fuel intercontinental ballistic missile called Hwasong-18 during the test launch that took place early Thursday. According to the country's official KCNA news agency, the test was aimed at boosting Pyongyang's nuclear counterattack capability. The KCNA said the test proved the new ICBM's military efficiency as a strategic attack capability. The report added that the missile will dramatically improve North Korea's strategic deterrence and nuclear counterattack readiness. The launch came after the North's leader, Kim Jong-un, called for strengthening the country's war deterrence in a more practical and offensive manner to cope with aggression by the U.S. and South Korea. It also takes following joint drills by the U.S. and the South, which are considered by Pyongyang rehearsals for invasion of its territory. U.S. federal agents have arrested a man suspected of being behind the recent major leak of a trove of highly classified Pentagon files. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland said the arrest was made in connection with an investigation into illegal, unauthorized removal, retention and transmission of classified national defense information. Confirmed the 21-year-old suspect, called Jack Teixeira, was an employee of U.S. Air Force National Guard. He was reportedly leading an online chat group where the documents first emerged. U.S. Defense Department has called the leak a deliberate criminal act. The highly sensitive documents were circulating on social media for months before receiving media attention last week. Many of the documents are related to the Ukraine war, but others show Washington has been spying on its key allies, including Kiev, Tel Aviv, and Seoul. The Brazilian president has lashed out at the U.S. dollar's dominance in the world economy while on a visit to China to boost bilateral trade. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva made the remark in a ceremony held to inaugurate his political ally Dilma Rousseff as president of the BRICS Development Bank. He said the BRICS nation, including Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa, should have their own bank to finance their trade transaction. He also took a jab at the International Monetary Fund, accusing the world body of forcing harsh spending cuts on cash-strapped countries. Lula said the IMF asphyxiates the economies of countries like Argentina and Brazil. Lula's Beijing visit is aimed at resetting bilateral relations after a frosty 4 years under his predecessor Jair Bolsonaro. Last month, the two countries reached a deal to use their own currencies in trade transactions, ditching the U.S. dollar as an intermediary. French President Emmanuel Macron has visited Beijing and held talks with China's senior officials on bilateral relations. Macron says China has a, quote, major role to play on the path to Ukraine peace. He has also provoked a backlash in the United States and Europe by urging the European Union to reduce dependence on the U.S. Macron cautioned against being drawn into a crisis over Taiwan.
On April the 5th, French President Emmanuel Macron made a three-day visit to China. It was Macron's first presidential visit to China since the COVID pandemic. The French president called on European countries to lower their dependence on the US dollar and resist pressure to become vassal states of Washington or get dragged into the China-US conflict over Taiwan. If the tensions between the two superpowers heat up, we won't have the time nor the resources to finance our strategic autonomy and we will become vassals. He further noted that the great risk for Europe is to get involved in a crisis that does not belong to it. The worst thing would be to think that we Europeans must be followers and adapt ourselves to the American rhythm and a Chinese overreaction.
La France est pour le quo à Taiwan.
France is for the status quo in Taiwan. France supports the One China policy and the search for a peaceful settlement of the situation. This is moreover the position of the Europeans and is a position which has always been compatible with the role of ally. But it is precisely here that I insist on the importance of a strategic autonomy. Being allies does not mean being a vassal.
The comments come amid heightened tensions between the US and China over Taiwan. China staged a large-scale military drill after Taiwan's leader met with the US House Speaker in California.
China and France have further expanded their economic and trade cooperation through the visit, which in fact has once again confirmed that the economic and trade cooperation acts as the ballast and stabilizer of the bilateral relations. As it is known to all, the visit took place against the backdrop that the United States is clamoring about decoupling or disruption of industrial chains of China. And the Biden administration has also been suppressing his European allies in the aspect. Therefore, the consensus and the fact that both sides continue to advance economic and trade cooperation by consolidating traditional domains and exploring new fields during the visit of President Macron to China are a powerful response to the so-called decoupling and disruption policies of the US.
Macron highlighted the point that Europe should be a third power in the world order along with the US and China. He also emphasized the risks to Europe of the US Inflation Reduction Act, a $369 billion green subsidy plan. Macron also said Europe should reduce its dependence on the extraterritoriality of the US dollar, a stance that is likely to raise eyebrows in Washington.
Macron's comments have raised eyebrows among Western allies, triggering deep concerns over the transatlantic alliance between Paris and Washington. The White House sought to play them down, but hawkish US lawmakers have criticized Macron. There are now calls within the EU to dismiss the European Council. EU cannot blindly and systematically follow Washington.
Macron's comments about Europe's independence from the United States and its devastating reliance on the US dollar has sparked anger and concern in Washington. The White House reapparently affirmed ties with Paris.
Again, I'll let President Macron speak to his comments. We're very comfortable and confident in the strong alliance and the strong friendship that exists between our two countries and the fact that we have been working together on the continent. And elsewhere around the world with France, whether it's, I mentioned the Indo-Pacific, certainly on Ukraine, in Africa, in the Sahel, going after terrorist threats there. I mean, there's a lot of terrific bilateral cooperation just alone between the United States and France. We're focused on that. We're focused on making sure that together we're meeting the national security requirements of both our peoples.
Earlier, Republican Senator Marco Rubio urged European countries to clarify pretty quickly if Macron spoke for Europe or France alone.
And so I think this is a good moment for us to ask Europe, does Macron speak for all of Europe? Is Macron now the head of Europe? Is he now the most powerful leader in Europe? Because if he is, then there's some things we're going to need to change. Number one, you know, Europe, including France specifically, has depended heavily on the United States for 70 years for their own defense. As far as not getting involved in other conflicts that are not ours, we need to ask Europe, does he speak for them? Because we're pretty heavily involved in Ukraine right now. We're spending a lot of our taxpayer money on a European war.
Since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, it's been Europe which has paid the high price for the conflict. The war has mostly benefited and its huge military-industrial complex. That's one of the reasons why the Washington regime is pumping more weapons to Ukraine to keep the war going. Furthermore, France is seeking economic independence from the United States. Just recently, France conducted its first LNG purchase in the Chinese yuan. The roots of France's diplomacy of balance date back to General Charles de Gaulle's attempts to counterweight U.S. dominance. Under de Gaulle, France became the first Western nation to recognize the People's Republic of China back in 1964.
But I think fundamentally, what Macron is aiming at is strengthened Europe with regards to Russia, with regards to China, and also with regards to the US, I think is something that is largely shared within Europe. The problem being that his style of communication, his vocabulary, strategic autonomy, European sovereignty, is at times misunderstood, misinterpreted.
Macron may not be able to persuade the whole European bloc to reduce its dependence on the United States.
The United Nations is reviewing its presence in Afghanistan after women were barred from working for the organization. Our correspondent Abdullah Mirzadeh reports from Kabul.
In a recent statement, the UN has announced that it is reviewing its presence in Afghanistan. The recent announcement comes after the Taliban authorities banned Afghan women from working for the UN in the country. The organization claims that the ban is unlawful under international law, including the UN Charter, and for that reason the body cannot comply. Experts say the UN might be affected by political interference at this point.
When the UN was founded, its goal was to work towards global peace, to control crises in countries, but unfortunately it is affected by some now. For example, the five members in the UN Security Council, if the interests of one of these countries bend towards a certain path, the UN shows flexibility. The UN, as an impartial organization, has responsibility towards Afghanistan. Historically speaking, the UN has always been unsuccessful in controlling the crisis in the country. And now more pressure and sanctions on the Islamic Emirate isn't called crisis control, but crisis intensifier.
The Taliban calls the ban an internal matter, religious and cultural issue. Taliban says that they do not want to create an obstacle for the UN. In a statement, the spokesman of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, Zabihullah Mujahid, demanded all parties to respect the decision made by the Islamic Emirate. Experts say both sides should show flexibility and cooperate for the sake of the nation to manage the problem.
To manage this issue, the UN and the IEA both should show flexibility. They should reach a mutual agreement that doesn't violate each side's laws. If the UN shuts down its operations in Afghanistan while the country is in poverty and is in dire need of UN services, the poverty rate would be increased and it might impact the women whom are the neediest.
The UN has in its statement threatened that any negative consequences of this crisis for the Afghan people will be the responsibility of the de facto rulers. However, the Islamic Emirate has replied by saying that those who have imposed restrictions on the financial and banking system of Afghanistan, crippling the economy in the first place, should be blamed. The UN has initiated an operational review period during which consultations and adjustments will be made. May 5th is the expected date to see what would the UN and the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan determine on this issue. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Our voice comes from the heart of Biran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
World Quds Day, time of unity with Palestinians. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The last Friday of the blessed month of Ramadan was called as World Quds Day by Imam Khomeini in 1979 to cause Muslims all over the globe converge on the sacred cause of Palestine and fight for annihilation of the fabricated criminal regime called Israel. In 1979, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, called on all Muslims across the world to mark the last Friday of Ramadan as Quds Day through rallies and demonstrations to support the legal right of the Palestinian nation and liberation of the land. The support of the Islamic Ummah for the Palestinian cause and the announcement of hatred against the usurpers and their cohorts and accomplices in the West will surely send new blood into the vessels of the resistance front. This will nullify the notorious Abraham Agreement and condemn any normalization of relations with the fake Zionist regime by a handful of Arab regimes. This year, the World Quds Day demonstrations are going to be held while the fabricated regime of Israel is in its waning years, as it has become very shaky from inside and the regime has faced the change of four cabinets only in 1 year. The Zionist regime is experiencing the most critical periods of its unholy existence as internal crises have surged and the resistance front has become more powerful than ever. Accordingly, many observers believe that the regime's disintegration and destruction is very imminent. Imam Khomeini said on the World Quds Day, "The Quds Day is not just the day of Palestine, it is the day of Islam. The Quds Day is global and it is not a day to only belong to Quds. It is the day of the confrontation of the downtrodden with the arrogant." In fact, the World Quds Day is the symbol of unity and willpower of the Islamic Ummah against the Zionist regime. It is the day of resistance of the downtrodden and oppressed in the world against the oppressors and arrogant. This is the day to lay bare the criminal image of Israel to the dormant consciences in the world. Today, the World Quds Day is marked in more than 80 countries across the globe. Beitul Muqaddas is sacred to Muslims as it was the first Qibla or focal point of prayer before Mecca. It is also sacred for Christians and Jews as it holds many holy spots and tombs of hundreds of prophets. However, the heads of the Zionist regime consider their survival is linked to this city. In view of this, they have spent exorbitant amounts of money on construction of Jewish settlements in the city and around it, especially for the past 2 decades. This has been put on the agenda of the usurper regime to change the fabric of the city and, in fact, destroy it. The spread of the resistance culture will lead to the further exposure of the real face of the Israeli regime and will again emphasize on the need for unity against the fake regime as the arch enemy of the Muslim nations and the whole mankind. One day, Palestinians used to stand against the Zionist occupiers. They have been equipped with rockets and are going to drive out the Zionists from their country. This has seriously horrified the fake Zionist regime and turned into a nightmare for them. Now, new groups like Arinul Osud or Forest of Lions have emerged from the young Palestinians who enjoy very high motive to destroy the fabricated regime and take back their occupied land. Thus, the treacherous moves by a handful of Arab regimes to normalize ties with Israel have failed, and the people of the West Bank have joined the people of Gaza, and the resistance front is spreading more than ever. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said on the importance of the World Quds Day, "We are on the threshold of the Quds Day. The Quds Day is very important. It is not merely that we defend an oppressed nation, which has been expelled from its land and house. We are, in fact, struggling in this way against an oppressive and arrogant political system. Today, defending Palestine is defending truth, a truth much broader than the issue of Palestine. Today, the struggle against the Zionist regime is the struggle against the domineering system. As you see, when you speak against the Zionist regime, that American official and politician feels enmity and hostility with you. He feels that you have struck him. This is the reality of the issue. Therefore, the Quds Day should be glorified. The Quds Day demonstration is also very important." The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has said several times that the issue of Palestine is the most important issue among the Islamic countries. Once he said, "The Zionists have turned the usurped Palestine into a base of terrorism since day one. Israel is not a country, but a terrorist garrison against the Palestinian nation and other Muslim nations. The struggle against this blood-shedding regime is a struggle against oppression and a struggle against terrorism, and this is a public duty." Martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani breathed a new life into the resistance front against the Zionist regime and was finally killed by the main supporter and comrade in crime of the Israeli regime, the United States of America. Obviously, global solidarity with the issue of Palestine and the Holy Quds will strengthen the morale of the combatants in the resistance front and will expedite the trend of the annihilation of the Zionist regime, which has already started.
When we look at the biography of Muhaqqiq Tabatabai, we see, besides being the student of great, outstanding maraji' like Sayyid al-Khu'i, he is also the great student to outstanding bibliographers and codicologists like Sheikh Agha Buzurg Tehrani and like Allama Amini.
One of the most important works done by him is book that is completing Al-Dhari'ah, Mustadraku Al-Dhari'ah. The books that are not mentioned in Al-Dhari'ah, he is trying to, you know, have an index of them.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. The Teacher is about the works and the lives of the most outstanding Muslim, especially the Shiite scholars, jurists, and ulama of the world of Islam. And with me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic Hawza of Qom, Sheikh Ziyaniya and Sheikh Mahdavi. Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Today we want to talk about one of the most outstanding bibliographer and codicologist, especially the Shiite one of the 14th and the 15th century Hijra, who has spent most of his life on doing research regarding the Shiite references, books, resources, and bibliographies and manuscripts. And in fact, I do want to say he was truly the protector of the Shiite legacy, I call this man, especially in the scholarly sense of the word and the books and resources. He is no one but Sayyid Abdul Aziz Tabatabai Yazdi, mainly known as Muhaqqiq Tabatabai. Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's start with you. This episode of the program, give us some information about the early life and the background of Sayyid Abdul Aziz Tabatabai Yazdi, mainly known as Muhaqqiq Tabatabai.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Sayyid Abdul Aziz Tabatabai Yazdi was born in Najaf in 1308 in solar calendar. And he is the grandson of late Ayatollah Tabatabai Yazdi, who is the author of Al-Urwatul Wuthqa. Nowadays, this book is one of the sources in the Kharij level.
Yes.
I mean, the PhD level in jurisprudence, yes, in Islamic seminaries of Qom and also Najaf.
The high levels.
And, yes. Yeah. And many scholars have, you know, written some, you know, exegesis and, you know, elaborations regarding this book.
Explications on Urva, like Muslim Sakal Urva al Wuthqa and so on.
It's somehow a norm that, yes, a man who is mujtahid,
yes,
he tries to have some explanation on this book.
So Muhaqqiq Yazdi is the
grandson of Sayyid Tabatabai Yazdi, the author of Urva al Wuthqa.
Very good.
This figure, Sayyid Abdul Aziz Tabatabai Yazdi, started his studying from his childhood in Najaf, and you know, his father also was a scholar, a prominent scholar, and he, you know, brought up from the, you know, beginning years of his life in libraries.
Yes.
He himself says that when I was a young boy, about 7-8 years old, there was a library, because I was too young, they, you know, were not letting me in,
yes,
to touch the books. But I used to go inside the library and just watch the books and, yes, started writing the names of the books in a list that, mm-hmm, I made to have them, you know, in a index,
yes,
and to, you know, get them and make them in an order.
Yes.
So from that age, he started some scholarly works, mm-hmm, and, you know, decided to know books.
That's right.
And we will find out that in his, you know, future life,
yes,
when he becomes to be a prominent scholar, this will be his major field.
Yes.
And we will see that he is assisting,
yes,
some of the, you know, very great scholars like Allama Amini Rahmatullah Alayhi, yes, regarding compiling the book Al-Ghadir, and also Sheikh Agha Buzurg Tehrani Rahmatullah Alayhi, that's regarding,
right,
the compiling the book Al-Dhari'ah. Because,
right,
he was prominent in, you know, to be a codicologist,
yes,
and to, you know, making lists of,
yes,
the books,
yes,
in a very professional manner.
Very good. So the main interest in the younghood, I mean in the books, made him interested choosing this specific field of study, you know, as his major and the future when he got older. That's all right. Sheikh Mahtavi, so his main interest in bibliography and codicology, the manuscripts and the books, you know, helped him very much, up to the extent that the Amir al-Mu'minin Library of Allama Amini, you know, selected him as the main person who is in charge of listing or indexing the books over there. And this is really a difficult task, you know, for a librarian to do, especially when you are dealing with the old manuscripts, because the old manuscripts needs a specific type of knowledge of handwriting, you know, of the authenticity of the book, the date of the publication, and so on. So talk a little bit about this field of study. I mean, codicology and bibliography, Muhaqqiq Tabatabai was specialized in.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think this is good for our listeners to know that the common field of studies ahead of all students of seminary schools are fiqh and usul, that will make them to be expert in terms of riwayat and extracting the sharia laws based on the riwayat. When we look at the biography of Muhaqqiq Tabatabai, that we see, besides being the student of great outstanding maraji like Sayyid al-Khu'i, he is also the great student or the very talented student to outstanding bibliographers and codicologists like Sheikh Agha Buzurg Tehrani and like Allama Amini. And this field of study, although it is not known to all, this is really important.
Yes.
Why? Because everything that scholar is going to rely on depends on the authenticity of the book or the authenticity of the manuscript they are relying on. And where they can distinguish between the authenticated and fabricated manuscript in this field of study. So when person reaches the level of perfect codicologists, he is able to distinguish between the fabricated manuscripts and the genuine one. So when we call محقق طباطبایی as the great bibliographers, we have to acknowledge his role in terms of the great contribution that he did to this field of study. And we have to take into consideration that he really benefited from his asatid, Allama Amini. 25 years he was accompanying Allama Amini, and Allama Amini was trusting him a lot, to the extent that it is recorded in his biography that he was assigning him to go to different libraries in Turkey, in India, in England to find out about the manuscript and transcribe them. And in some of the trips, in accompany with the son of Allama Amini, who was go and move to all these countries.
That's right. Very good.
So that is a very good job.
As a trustworthy deputy or representative.
Yes, and it was not only limited to Allama Amini. Also, Sheikh Agha Buzurg Tehrani would trust him the same. That it is also said that volume 13 and volume 14 of Al-Dhari'a was the whole volume.
Yes.
Because he actually was associating in terms of compiling the Al-Dhari'a. Mm-hmm. He was presenting a good contribution to compiling of the whole Al-Dhari'a. But in terms of volume 13 and volume 14, it is said that these two volumes are compiled based on his transcription of the actually inquiry that he had done.
Yes, yes.
So we see that it was not just talking about being a codicologist.
Yes.
And he was a kind of prominent codicologist.
You know, the importance of the thing is that he was living during a time that the digital information and the digital searching was not available at all. Because if you got, for example, to go to the libraries and, you know, you have to make the checklist or the notes out of the so many books and references that are over there, this is really, I think, hard work to do and needs lots of efforts. Something in which, you know, as you said, Agha Buzurg Tehrani, Allama Amini trusted him very much. And especially when you got this power of knowing which book is genuine and original and which is not, you know, especially when you get to the Ahadith book or the history of Islam and the events on that time, this would become very much important. So Sheikh Ziaunia, did he himself had any independent book or something? I mean, compiling for himself?
Yes, he had, you know, many works done by himself, you know, independently. But, you know, many of them are not published yet. And when he is asked in an interview that why you did not publish your own books, he says that I didn't have enough time.
That's right.
Because I'm very busy regarding, you know, these researches that I'm, you know, doing.
Yes.
So I didn't have time to get my books ready for being published.
That's right.
But one of the most important, you know, works done by him is the book that is completing Al-Dhari'a, Mustadraku Al-Dhari'a.
Mustadraku Al-Dhari'a, that's right.
That is the books that are not mentioned in Al-Dhari'a. He is trying to, you know, have an index of them. But unfortunately, he was not, you know, successful to complete it.
He passed away?
Yes.
In the middle of the way, that's right. Okay.
But he, you know, compiled something like 11,000 names of the books that were not mentioned in Al-Dhari'a.
Yes.
And another point that we should mention regarding his personality is that beside having, you know, relationship with Shia scholars, he had good relationship with, you know, Orientalists.
Orientalists, that's right.
Because, you know, he was in need of, you know, have access to the libraries all around the world to get the, you know, manuscripts.
That's right.
So, for example, he had relationship with Fuat Sezgin, mm-hmm. the Orientalist from Turkey,
yes.
and some other figures.
Yes.
And he was in need of traveling too much, you yes. know, and this traveling for a scholar, especially in his, you know, old age is yeah. very hard.
It's
and,
a back-breaking you know, work,
taking
that's right.
too much energy yeah. of him. So he take all this burden to help late Allama Amini and late Agha Bozorg Tehrani to, you know, collect
yes.
the, let me say, the encyclopedia of the books
right.
of Shia school Shia, of thought right. and also the encyclopedia of Al-Ghadir
that's
that
right.
is trying to collect every information yes. regarding the event of Al-Ghadir.
Yes, you know, just accompanying these two scholars in the magnum opus like Az-Zariya and Al-Ghadir is enough.
Yeah.
These are really, you know, hard works, especially when he goes to different libraries across the world. He tried to make a checklist or the list of the manuscripts for that library, like the Amir al-Mu'minin Library in Najaf, we said, Astana-Quds Razavi Library in Iran, in Mashhad, you know, and some other libraries in Baghdad. Even he went to Hejaz, you know, and some did some research over there, Turkey, Shiraz, and Tabriz in Iran. Really great, outstanding works. And there is a foundation in Iran called Bunyad-e-Muhaqqiq-e Tabatabai, which is really famous, you know, especially in doing researches on the books and the manuscripts. The offsprings of Muhaqqiq Yazdi are still active in this field of study in that foundation. Okay, anything missed? Sheikh Madhavi Shakhsiyeh, okay.
I think one of the good works being done by Muhaqqiq Tabatabai that for our listeners, they can benefit from this work if they get familiar with this is Faza'il Amir al-Mu'minin li-Ibn Hanbal. We know the meaning actually is the merits of Amir al-Mu'minin yes. li-Ibn Hanbal. Actually, this is a controversial topic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for one of the great imams of Ahlus Sunnah to compile the merits of Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, it's actually a kind of controversial topic.
Okay.
What kind of methodology he does in order... Actually, this is not the work that he authored.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the great codicological work that he did.
Mm-hmm.
So three very important thing he did upon this work. First of all, he wanted to elaborate on the topic of the work.
That's right.
So what do we mean by the merits of Amir al-Mu'minin? He elaborates on this.
In the views of Ibn al-Hanbal.
Is it so? Yes.
Okay.
Saying that when we a personality, we mean his advantages, morality, the way people would talk about his behavior, and good things that he would do during his life.
That's all right.
This is his elaboration on the topic. So when we talk about the merits of Amir al-Mu'minin, these are the stuff that we are going to cover and include in the book. Yes. Second of all, he goes and tries to trace back this book from the time of Ibn Hanbal till the 7th century. So he says, when we go and we find out the books which were in charge of covering the titles and the books of their time in all centuries, after Ibn Hanbal, we see the name of this book being attributed to Ibn Hanbal.
That's all right.
This is a very perfect job.
This is
why?
Really
because amazing. Right now, somebody may say, who said that Ibn Hanbal has done this work?
Mm-hmm.
So he traces back the time of publication of the book from the time of Ibn Hanbal till the 7th century.
Century, that's
yes.
right. Okay.
And the last thing that he okay. tries to do in terms of this book actually is the value of this book
mm-hmm.
in the eyes of the authors and different manuscripts being collected in different libraries.
That's all right.
So I think right now, we feel really comfortable to quote Faza'il Amir al-Mu'minin from the book of Ibn Hanbal.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because we have such a great, powerful work behind us.
Yeah.
So if you quote something from yes. this book, if yes. somebody yes. comes up saying that, okay, who said this book?
You made this out of your own mind for
so
Amir al-Mu'minin.
That is a great
yes.
job he has yeah. done, and we have to really appreciate.
That's all right.
This is one of the works. I just wanted to
yes.
Elaborate on the value of the works that
yes.
he has done
That's
and the
right.
contribution that he did upon
right.
the Library of Shia.
Okay, really, what a fruitful life this outstanding man had, you know, and how much sacrifice on doing research in the books and writing down and making lists of the Shiite world. May Allah bless him and may Allah protect all the Shiite bibliographers and codicologists all across the world. Ramadan 7th, 1416 was the year that he passed away. He was buried in the main yard of Lady Masuma, holy shrine in the holy city of Qom, the city from which this program is produced. May Allah bless his soul, and may Allah bless the soul of all the Shiite scholars all across the world. And thank you, Sheikh Ziyania.
You're most welcome.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, thank you very much, brother.
You
for
are
a nice
most welcome.
Elaboration on the life and works of Sayyid Abdul Aziz Tabatabai Yazdi, mainly known as Muhaqqiq Tabatabai. Thank you much, dear listeners, too, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode and introducing another Shiite dignitary, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
An analyst known for accurately predicting past crises has claimed that a recent spate of failures in the US portends economic trouble and bank and cryptocurrency failures ahead. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted Stephanie Pombe, the U.S. economist known for her predictions of America's early 2000s housing bubble and the 2008 global financial collapse, has sounded the alarm on a recent spate of bank and cryptocurrency failures that could be just the beginning of another cascading crisis in the U.S. What we are facing right now is really serious, Pombe, founder of economic research firm Macro Maven, said recently in a Fox News interview, adding, "We are on the brink of a 2008-style financial crisis." She made her assessment in the wake of the recent shutdown of Silicon Valley Bank, SVB, by federal regulators, the second largest failure in U.S. banking history. SVB's collapse came on the heels of this week's closure of cryptocurrency lender Silvergate Bank, as well as the bankruptcies last fall of crypto firms FTX, BlockFi, and Three Arrows Capital.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen issued a statement recently declaring that the U.S. banking system remains resilient and regulators have effective tools to address this type of event. Pomboy was unconvinced, mocking Yellen for an absolutely insane focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion at a time when rapid increases in interest rates by the U.S. Federal Reserve are exposing the fragility of the nation's debt-laden financial system. The Economist said, "Look, you don't raise rates in record fashion on an economy touting record leverage at maximum speculation and expect no consequences." Adding, "This was clearly going to happen, and now we are seeing the weak links in the chain break. The areas where speculation was most rampant and most egregious are clearly coming down." She added that years of excessive risk-taking are coming back to bite them hard and predicted that the situation will devolve very rapidly. Republican presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy argued that just as in the 2008 financial crisis, which stemmed partly from the federal government's push to ease credit standards in low-income communities, SVB's failure may have been fueled by politics. In SVB's case, a focus on so-called sustainable finance, or ESG, may have contributed to bad lending decisions, he said, adding, "When we don't learn lessons, history repeats itself." Billionaire hedge fund manager Bill Ackman warned that SVB's failure may trigger runs on other troubled banks, causing a 2008-like chain reaction as the dominoes continue to fall. Meanwhile, New York Times noted the U.S. economy could quickly shed a million jobs and fall into recession if lawmakers fail to raise the nation's borrowing limit before the federal government exhausts its ability to pay its bills on time. The chief economist of Moody's Analytics, Mark Zandi, warned a Senate panel recently. The damage could spiral to 7 million jobs lost and a 2008-style financial crisis in the event of a prolonged breach of the debt limit, in which House Republicans refused for months to join Democrats in voting to raise the cap. Zandi and his colleagues Kristen Riritis and Bernard Yaros wrote in an analysis prepared for the Senate Banking Committee Subcommittee on Economic Policy. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, held the subcommittee hearing on the debt limit and its economic and financial consequences at a moment of fiscal brinksmanship. House Republicans are demanding deep spending cuts from Biden in exchange for voting to raise the debt limit, which caps how much money the government can borrow. That debate is likely to escalate when Biden releases his latest budget proposal. The president is expected to propose reducing America's reliance on borrowed money by raising taxes on high earners and corporations. But he almost certainly will not match the level of spending cuts that will satisfy Republican demands to balance the budget in a decade. The report also warns of a stark economic damage if Biden, in an attempt to avert a default, agrees to those demands. In that scenario, the dramatic spending cuts that would be needed to balance the budget would push the economy into recession in 2024, cost the economy 2.6 million jobs, and effectively destroy a year's worth of economic growth over the next decade, Zandi and his colleagues wrote. They said the only real option is for lawmakers to come to terms and increase the debt limit in a timely way. Any other scenario results in
significant economic damage. The economy is very vulnerable, he added, saying, even without the debt limit drama, the recession risks are high. It won't take much to push us in, and this is certainly a lot more than much. Zandi's analyses are frequently cited by the Biden administration in support of its economic policy proposals. In this case, Warren is using the Moody's work to push Biden in a letter sent to the White House this week to resist Republican demands for spending cuts and instead continue insisting on a debt limit increase that is not tied to any changes in fiscal policy. Warren, in an interview, said everyone has been talking up to now about how dangerous it would be to default on the national debt, and that's right. But it would be even more dangerous to give in to the Republican cuts. The president has stood strong, and I urge him to continue to do that. Zandi's projections join a growing list of warnings from forecasters on Wall Street and at Washington think tanks about the consequences of failing to increase the borrowing limits in a timely manner. House Republicans have refused to raise the limit unless Biden agrees to deep but unspecified cuts in federal spending. They say the nation's current levels of debt, accumulated in bipartisan fashion over two decades of the federal government spending more money than it receives in tax revenue, pose a current and future threat to economic growth. The government hit its statutory $31.4 trillion debt limit in January. The Treasury Department is employing what is essentially accounting maneuvers that allow it to continue to pay all its bills on time. But those maneuvers work only for a third limited time. Independent groups like the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington and the Congressional Budget Office have estimated that sometime this fall, the U.S. government will no longer be able to pay everyone, including bondholders, Social Security recipients, and federal employees, on time. The Moody's team estimates that deadline, known as the X date, will fall on August 15th.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.